welcome to episode 588 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Valiant Sunday episode, and we're continuing with the chronology. We're moving on from the first couple volumes of Exo Manowar onto probably what is my favorite Valiant series ever, still to this day. It's Harbinger, and we're lucky enough, Jesse and I, to be joined by the writer of Harbinger, Josh Dysart. Welcome back to the show, Josh. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's always super fun to be here.
Yeah, man, it's always great to talk to you. We were just talking before we started recording how we kind of get going. So we'll try to keep it. We'll try to keep it around, you know, 40 minutes to an hour. We won't bore you too much. But
I'm not scared of you.
Yeah, exactly.
I can take it.
Exactly. You can handle it. But before we get into Jesse and I talking about the first issue in detail and moving on through the chronology, I thought it would be fun because you're currently about to have the Life and Death of Toyo Harada drop, which may be kind of your final statement on kind of the Harbinger corner of the Valiant Universe. I thought it would be great to have you on to kind of look back now that it's been a little while. So for listeners that may be not that familiar, how would you describe the story of Harbinger to somebody who knows nothing?
So, you know, my weakest point has always been like pitching my own books, and Harbinger in particular, because honestly, I think on the surface, Harbinger is a pretty standard pitch, right? It's basically a group of disenfranchised young people with superpowers find themselves completely at odds with the leader of the largest corporation on the planet, who also happens to be one of the most powerful meta beings, super beings. We call them psyots in our universe, most powerful super powered, you know, person on the planet. And that's basically it. But hopefully it becomes more interesting through characterization, through attack on its central themes of various conflicts in our society. Like, you know, there's a generational conflict involved in the book. There's a paternal conflict involved in the book, or parental conflict. There's a class conflict. So, you know, hopefully the book becomes rich beyond just sort of its like surface pitch.
Yeah, I think
that's the best I got.
I think that that's what is so interesting about it, because yeah, on the surface you can sum it up in a sentence or two, but right from the first issue, when I picked it up and read it, it's so layered. There's so much there. You know, in terms of momentum and events, there's not a lot of movement in the first issue, but it still immediately hooks you because of the depth of it.
Yeah, I think that we have this sort of, as storytellers, more and more we're losing this idea that movement can occur in all kinds of ways inside of a story. It doesn't have to be a narrative momentum. It can be characterological momentum. It can be thematic momentum. And that's something that, as we enter into this sort of blockbuster age where in movies we have an explosion every 10 pages. I'm such a comic book writer. Well, we have an explosion every 10 minutes, or in comics where you have to have an action scene every issue. We've sort of forgotten that there are other story propellants than just action or just obvious narrative. So I really try to put a lot of that in my work and make sure my comics don't fall into these kind of stereotypical structural beats.
Now, you mentioned how you always kind of struggled to sum up the Harbinger story or the pitch of the title. Has that synopsis in your mind changed at all as the story changed?
Well, not the surface pitch. You know, the surface pitch has always sort of been the same. The act of doing, the act of creating, like a story, particularly a monthly serialized comic book narrative, is a real organic beast. So obviously your relationship to the themes and your relationship to the characters as the writer changes over time. But the basic gist, the thing you sit down to execute, you're almost shackled to that. Mm-hmm. And you got to make it as interesting as you can. And you spend the next few years plumbing the depths of that original concept. But it's very hard to change that concept once you've dropped anchor on it.
Yeah, now we recently had Robert Venditti on the show, and he was talking about, and it's such a great story. I love when Rob talks about how when Warren Simons reached out to him and was asking him to pitch for, you know, giving him this list of characters that he could possibly pitch for, and Rob was saying, yeah, I got to be honest with you, Warren, not only do I not know like who Exo Manowar is, I don't even know what Valiant is. And yeah. Warren was like,
well, that was Robert's great strength, right? Is that yeah. he came in like a babe. Yeah. You know, I don't even remember who it was, but there's a famous Japanese filmmaker from the 30s or 40s who had never seen a movie before he directed his first film and had done all these things in the movie that are, you know, they're completely out of left field because it was his interpretation of how to make a movie. Robert has a little bit of that sort of beginner's mind attitude to it that I actually think makes him a very strong writer in a lot of respects.
Yeah, I think that's part of why he's killing it on Hawkman right now. But I wonder, do you remember how, like, when Warren...
Well, he's also getting a hell of an art assist on Hawkman, man. Those pages, not to take anything away from Rob, because I love the man, but those pages are sick.
Yeah, they really are. They really are. But how did you, like, do you remember that call from Warren, or was it even from Warren? Like, how did you come to be involved with Harbinger?
Yeah, so I got cold called by Warren, and you know, we talked a little bit about this, but I'll say it again. I apologize if your listeners have heard this story, but I had I was in some pretty dire straits. I had finished a book in 2010. I mean, the last issue came out, but you know, I had finished it in 2009 because of the long tail of comics production, and called Unknown Soldier. And a bit of a humble brag, you know, it had been nominated for 3 Eisners. It was on the front page of the New York Times art section. The Guardian in the UK had run like all these articles on it. So I thought I was pretty set up. Like I had done it. I had a book that a lot of people talked about and had a lot of attention. And then it was just crickets after that. Really hard to get a job. And I was picking up a few jobs here and there. And, honestly, when Warren cold called me, I didn't know Warren. I hadn't established a relationship with him. This may be the first time in my career that I got completely cold called by an editor, somebody I hadn't, you know, built a relationship mm-hmm. with. And but I mean, at that point, I was picking up job applications at bookstores, which is the only experience in this life that I have other than writing comic books is working in bookstores. And you know, and which at the point at which they were dying, and I'm like, I thought that was the end of my comic book career. I just couldn't rustle up rent when Warren called. So when he called, I didn't have any. I, like Rob, I had some understanding of Valiant. I had really loved when I was younger, in the 90s, the Barry Windsor Smith, Archer and Armstrong stuff. Uh-huh. And that was about the extent of my Valiant reading at that point. But yeah, I was really desperate for a gig, so I was ready to pay Warren all kinds of attention, you know, when he called.
So at that point, he says Harbinger, and then what?
Well, not really, no. What he does is he says, here's all these characters. Well, you know, Warren's like plays the game like a Roman senator. Like he's always got some plan. He's always got some plan to knife Caesar on the Senate floor, but he pretends like he doesn't. So he said, yeah, I've got all these characters, you know, let me know what you think about them. So he sent me essentially the whole dominant Valiant roster, or the roster they wanted to like launch with.
Right.
So there was Ninja, there was everybody but XO, right? Harbinger, Ninjak, Eternal Warrior, Archer and Armstrong. But I'm pretty sure that all along he wanted me to do Harbinger. But to be frank, I wasn't really interested in Harbinger. I thought Eternal Warrior would have been awesome. Because of my love of the original Archer and Armstrong series, I thought I could take a swing at Archer and Armstrong, which thank God I didn't do that because Fred was great with it, and I just would not have been as strong as Fred on that book. And you know, so I wrote a Ninjak. I wrote like a paragraph pitch for all these characters, but I don't think Warren had any intention of ever putting me on anything but Harbinger. I think he just was trying to wear down my resistance to right. the book. Yeah.
So once it was decided, okay, well, we like your idea for Harbinger, and you started developing your narrative, there must have been at some point where a switch flipped, right? And you did start getting excited and go, oh, wait.
Absolutely. Well, that's like Warren's magic, right? This is why I can't ever, like Warren knew that was the book for me, even though I didn't. And so, okay, there's always a natural process with anyone who creates anything, and that the minute they begin to drill down into the act of creation, they immediately start falling in love with it. And because that's part of the natural process. If you don't fall in love with your storyline and your characters, you're never going to turn this into anything authentic or interesting. You know, it's not going to have any real emotional power because you're not going to bring any emotional power to it. So that's a natural part of the process. And once that began to click, and I began to realize that actually this was the strongest vehicle in their arsenal for me to discuss the things that are interesting to me. Then it became a crusade.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Josh about that question. What was your initial intention? What were the themes you wanted to explore?
Well, I thought that, you know, once you started drilling down on the pitch, like the synopsis we mentioned earlier, right? It's young, disenfranchised people. And this is stuff that carried over from the original Harbinger. And it was always my intention to keep the spirit of that original Harbinger alive, because I think that's how you reboot a property. But so once I started unpacking that and being like, okay, what's here exactly? The first thing I saw was the generational divide. And that is really interesting to me, because more so at that time than now, we were in a position where it was very obvious that the generation who was in charge of resources, political power, et cetera, that they were the oldest generation to remain in charge for as long as they had in the history of the human species. Like, we had just never really had, you know, and that's because of a lot of sociological phenomena, like the baby boomer generation after World War II, and the fact that people are just living longer because of medical advances and all these things. But there was always a rest of power from one generation to another at a much younger age. And so that was super interesting to me, because I saw a real divide in my parents' generation and in my generation from the new generation that was sort of emerging. And now we just saw in this election, in other ways, there's like a real social change, because the younger generation is finally starting to take political power or take jobs in media, all the ways in which power moves inside of like a large economy like ours. So that was very interesting to me, was this idea that you had control, you had this one old man in control of so much. And he even spoke the rhetoric of youth, you know, to entice Peter Stanchek, for anyone who hasn't read it, you know, our central protagonist, more or less, to entice Peter Stanchek, he even says that, you know, he says it's your generation's time. But really, he's a resource hoarder. And so that was the first thing that really got me interested. And then I was also interested in kind of exploring both the upside and the downside of capitalism through Harada. So Harada, at that moment in his arc as a character, is using capitalism for tremendous altruism. You know, the medical bots. I mean, that's the thing I always wanted to make sure of, is that Harada, our quote-unquote villain, actually did great good in the world, and that you ultimately have to, as a reader, confront his personal actions against what he's done in, you know, for the species as a whole. So I also wanted to explore that a lot. Like, capitalism can exploit, capitalism can create, you know, new wealth. It can do all kinds of interesting things, you know, both good and bad. So those are the two things I was very much interested in. Thematically. Well, yeah.
And you feel like you've probably at this point been accomplished the examination of those themes in the stories you've told so far?
You know, for the most part, the tricky bit with the monthly comic bag is that you gotta, like, I know I just said earlier, you know, I try not to have like an explosion every 10 pages or whatever, but ultimately you gotta have like a robot, or you gotta have like a space invasion. I mean, it's just the nature of this sort of beast. And when you're firing on all cylinders and you're doing the best job that you're capable of, you manage to make your alien invasion about the theme of the book, right? That's the best of all possible worlds. But it doesn't always quite happen that way. And so often you take a detour away from your thematic intentions just to get to the stuff that's fun and that the readers love and that you love too. I mean, it's super awesome to like write fun stuff. You know, it's not all like heady intellectual bullshit. And so, So for the most part, I do think we brought up the themes that interested us. I do think those two themes in particular, we drilled down on pretty well. But you know, it's always this, it's always, you always never get it all down. You know, there's never a world in which you get it all down.
Yeah.
No, absolutely.
And I think what also is great about it, and we'll touch on this in a second, is the fact that no matter how much you examine that capitalistic altruism of Harada, the question is never really answered. I mean, you and I have talked about it, John. We've talked about it in panels. Harada, hero or villain. We've done episodes that have lasted hours on it, and that's just amazing. It's such a legacy and a testament to what an incredible character that you've created in.
Well, you know what's interesting about all of that is. I don't really have any faith in isms at all. No isms, right? So basically, over Harada's arc, and I do want to talk about Harbinger. I don't mean to kidnap it for this for Imperium or anything, but we witness Harada go from a hyper-capitalist to essentially a hyper-socialist. And yep. It turns out over the course of that arc that none of it doesn't change anything. It's the same shit. You know, and I think that it's ultimately because I don't believe that the ism, capitalism, socialism, etc. I don't believe that the ism is the problem, right? The ism isn't what's causing humanity to not elevate itself, to not be kind to one another on a great scale. What's causing the problem is human fallibility,
yep.
Human greed, human self-interest. And so you can drop any ism onto the human species and say, okay, now this is the model or the template by which you guys will govern yourselves and deploy resources and all the things that we have to do so that we can all have an equitable life. And it's not going to fucking work if there's one, I'm sorry, I'm cursing so much. It's not going to work if there's one, you know, if human nature doesn't get resolved somehow, if our inability to be kind to one another cannot be resolved, if our disastrous march for personal greed cannot be resolved, no ism will function. And that's ultimately Harada's, that's the story of Harada, right? He could be a capitalist, he could be a socialist, he could be a fascist, he could be anything, but until he resolves his own ego, he's always going to fail. And that's ultimately the story of humanity.
Yeah, and it's what's so fascinating. The way I always looked at it is that's the packaging, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the wrapping paper is. What matters is what's inside. You open up the package, and you still have imperfect humans at the center of it. And it kind of brings me to my next point, talking specifically about Peter Stanchek that we get introduced in the first issue, probably the most significant character in the first issue to me. And he's just so incredibly flawed right from the moment we meet him. And we can kind of understand why with the things he's dealing with. But it can even be to the point he's so flawed it's hard to see him as the protagonist. I was wondering what your thought process behind bringing him out and introducing him to us in such a way that his imperfections are so obvious.
So this is a super interesting thing to me about this because I have gone through a real, it's not a change of heart because I don't know if I did the wrong thing or not, but I have regrets about, or I second guess myself all the time about the way we portrayed Peter in that first issue. But your question was to my intentions at that time.
Right.
So my intentions at that time were that, so because we were telling a story about disenfranchised youth in a world in which they don't have any, you know, access to resources, but not just physical resources, but emotional resources. Like Peter has no access to love. He doesn't have any access to a familial foundation that we now realize makes people very, you know, strong. When you come from a strong family where love is clear and intentions and attentions are clear, then you are just a person who's better equipped for life. And Peter didn't have any of that. And I was interested in that. But the natural conclusion to that, I think, is that if you have immense power, but have never been loved, never had the familiarity of like a stable family unit, have been in and out of institutions your whole life, have been living on the street, had been made institutionally addicted to, you know, opioids and other narcotics, then you would probably do something extremely destructive with all that power that you have. Which is like the story of young men since time immemorial, but it's an ugly story and it's not one I mean to lionize. So, you know, at the time, that's where I was going from. I was like, okay, let's be honest about this. This is how broken this character would be. And these are the things this character would do to acquire love. He would demand love. He would take it. And he would, in that first issue, you know, he robs a person of their, he robs Chris of her free will. And, that is one I have to state, because I've been accused of not being sensitive to this issue. And, but that is 100% wrong. Like, what he did is almost impossibly unforgivable. So, but at the time it felt like the most honest thing we could say and do with the character. And so that's why we made that choice, but we didn't come to it lightly. And to be honest, and we could talk about this if you want or not, in retrospect, I'm not even sure if it was the right thing to do, because, you know, why do we have to be so honest in our superhero comics? We don't. Like, well, you know, why couldn't I have just, like most writers, much more successful writers than me would have made a character, who was kind of flawed, but didn't really do anything that actually hurt anybody, you know? And so that we could be like, oh, he's a cute, flawed protagonist. And for some reason, I have this thing inside me. I guess it's because I grew up in the 70s, watching like movies from the 70s. But it just didn't feel true to me. And so we made the choice that we made in that first issue. Which was for him to take the free will away from a woman and make her love him, which is, you know, really, really, really fucking evil. And now, in retrospect, even though I still think that was the most, like, honest choice for that character, I do find that it turns readers off. It makes readers, it's very difficult for readers, particularly women, understandably so, to... you know, to ever see Peter as a redeemable character. And, so I, you know, I really still wrestle with that. I really still have mixed feelings about it. Like, is it my job to just be honest and tell a rough narrative, or is it my job to create something that everyone can enjoy? And, you know, and yeah, so.
Well, I think Jesse's next question actually kind of touches on this, right?
Yeah, it's your job to tell a rough narrative. Yeah. People are going to be pissed off no matter what you do. They're going to judge you for no matter what you do. They're going to argue no matter what you do. And the reality is, human beings are flawed. If I were to give any 18-year-old on Earth the powers of Pete Sanchek, they would not necessarily be benevolent. They would not necessarily be...
I wouldn't have been, yeah.
Me neither.
Yeah, if you were to go on Facebook right now and ask that question, hey, what would you do with powers to, you know, manipulate minds, alter reality, or whatever the case, people would say, okay, if you were to look into their true heart and soul,
yeah,
you would see a lot of evil, because human beings are evil. And if you write a character that doesn't have that in them, you're not writing a real character. And it can piss people off, because reality is, you know, is offensive. But you did the right thing. You should never wrestle with that, because you know, you did the right thing.
Well, I think it's okay to wrestle with it too. I appreciate you saying that. And that's obviously what I was thinking at the time. But you know, it's you know, I question, is fiction supposed to be a mirror of our reality? I mean, there's two kinds of fiction in the world, right? You write from two different places. I ultimately think both are equally important. You are either holding up a mirror to society. You're saying, or you're writing for society now. You're saying, this is you. Look in the mirror. You're ugly, or you're beautiful, or whatever. Or you're writing a society that you wish you could have, right? So, you know, you're writing a society with more equality, with more, you know, you're ignoring things like racial inequality. And I think that's just as valid and just as important too, because we also have to create a roadmap to where we go. For some reason, I don't know why, I tend to gravitate towards holding a mirror up to things the way I see them, as opposed to like trying to create something that's going to help us see ourselves in a better light. So I'm just, that's my lot. Yeah, that's my lot.
Hard work, you know. And Josh, you know as well as I do that the goal of a writer is always Vol. You know, you got to challenge yourself. You got to experience new things that you can bring out in your writing.
Yeah.
If you were starting over and working on it now, of course, and Harbinger was coming out next year instead of back in 2012, you know, what would you do different? Or would you do anything different?
I think I would do two things. Well, I don't know for sure how I would handle the Peter Sanchez thing, but I would definitely second guess it. Hi, cute doggies. Sorry, I'm walking out in the world. So I would definitely sit down and have a long think about that, because I totally hear what you're saying, and I don't disagree, but I also know that we created a barrier to some readers. And the truth of the matter is I'm supposed to be a popular, or not popular in the sense I'm supposed to make a lot of money and be loved by many people. I mean, I'm supposed to be a populist writer, at least with Harbinger. You know, Harbinger needed to be a populist book. At the same time, because Valiant was a niche publisher emerging in a bloated market, we also had to be radically different from Marvel or DC, or there was no way we would survive. So, you know, and that was also part of the choices I made for Peter, was like, what would Marvel and DC not do? Because we kind of have to do what they would not do if we're going to pull this off. But I would sit down and I would think long and hard about how to execute that, about Peter Stanchek in the beginning. And the other thing I think I would attack differently is the way we introduce Faith. I'm not super happy with my very first Faith, but at the beginning, I wish I had made her, she's a little bit gullible and a little bit of a shut-in when it starts. And I think I'm interesting as she becomes, but without the power. And I think I would have still gotten a strong arc out of it. So I do have some regrets about that. But otherwise, I think we kind of, I mean, for the most part, I think we made some pretty good comics, to be honest.
Yeah, I think it's seminal work and it stands up. And, you know, kind of on the Pete Stanchek thing, I would say that, you know, we see all these, I mean, look at the recent shooting, you know, down in your neck of the woods, Thousand Oaks. And
yeah,
it's like, that's the same kind of, you know, background, you know, young, white, male, Pete Stanchek. And it's like, it's almost like he's even more relevant now. I almost feel like it's a story that needs to be read, you know, more so than ever about, yeah, looking at the dark side of things and the dark side of the choices that we make and the imperfections and our flaws and looking at our fiction to have it held up as a mirror so that we can grow and we can move past it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is why most writers make it very clear about who, you know, the villain and the hero is, right? So this shooter that we just had here, in a normal story, the shooter would be the villain, you know, and you would be one of the people who either was trying to stop him or who was tracking him or who, I mean, I don't mean to fictionalize this horrible event. So I want to be really careful with my language, but to map it as a work of fiction, that's how you would attack it. And so it's a little bit more difficult, though. I think some of the greatest work of, you know, artistic work of all time has come from this impulse. It's a little bit more difficult to put that type of person at the center of your narrative and to expect your audience to follow that character and care about what happens to that character. That's a much more difficult exercise. People have done it, but it definitely pushes your audience away a little bit in a way that, well, you know, some of your craft is to kind of invite your audience in, you know, not to argue with you guys that my book isn't awesome. I didn't mean to get on, but you know what?
You know, you got to remember here that everybody is the hero of their own story. And everybody's the villain in somebody else's story. And we have stuff like Natural Born Killers, if you remember back to the 90s and whatnot.
Of course.
We have Woody running around popping off people left and right. Now, I can't relate to them.
I can't relate
to them today because it's not psychologically congruent with me. I'm not morally congruent with that. However, there was a lot of people, a lot of disenfranchised teenagers in school at the time and whatnot. They were like, oh my God, this is my shit. This is my stuff. And they loved it, you know, and later on, you know, you had a couple of Rob Zombie flicks and stuff, and they'll show the dark side of humanity, and they'll actually empower these guys as the heroes of those stories, when in any other story, they would have been the villain.
And so, well, you know, of course, of course, the truth of Natural Born Killers is that they're not heroes, right? Is that the point of the story is that the media exalts like the worst of us, and that's why the film is cut and directed like you're flipping channels through the TV, right? Is that it's about media exalting violence above authenticity, and so, you know, thematically and formally it becomes very interesting, and that's what you have to do when you want to tell a story like this. The Rob Zombie flicks, by way of example, are just sort of an exercise in horror, right? It's like Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer or something like that. Not quite as good as Henry, but it's like, you know, that's one of the reasons why I love horror is because it's completely non-ethical. it's completely exploitational. And these are all, you know, these are all attacks on narrative. It's a little bit different than, of course, than what we were going for with Harbinger, where Peter Stanchek's arc was supposed to be, and we never really got this. We never got to finish it. And we can talk about this later, but Peter Stanchek's arc was supposed to be a redemption arc. Whereas the characters in Natural Born Killers, they have to die, you know, or whatever. And the Rob Zombie characters, there's no redeeming them. We just thrill in the idea that we're watching a narrative about a bunch of horrible human beings doing horrible things. Whereas Peter's story was supposed to be a redemption story, and hopefully will be in the future when another writer takes over. And you know, I have some ideas about what should be done with the character, but I don't want to, you know, tell other writers how to work. But I think there's an original template that I put in place that hasn't been followed that could lead to the redemption of Stanchek. But so that's a little bit different, you know, than just the villain at the heart of the story, basically.
Yeah, because really, I mean, we've talked, you know, we mentioned it. We've talked so many times about Harada, hero or villain. We've never talked Stanchek, hero or villain. And can somebody as flawed as Peter be redeemed? Can he ever reach his full potential? Can he do that as the character that you created? Like, would that be out of character for this fictional person you created?
That was always it's supposed to be a redemption story. And I do want to be a little bit careful while we talk about this, because Peter's original sin in the eyes of the reader is an act of forcing will and strength. Hi, cutie. Forcing will and strength onto a woman. So we have to be very careful about the way we discuss this, because it's easy for three men to sit around and be like, he's a redeemable character.
Right.
it's not necessarily our thing to decide. That's really in the mind of each reader and you know, how they approach the material. But as designed, it was supposed to be a redemption arc, even if he was never forgiven by Chris. And that's okay, because I do think that people become better, but you don't deserve the forgiveness of the person you victimized. You become better so that you don't victimize people in the future. You become better for the next relationship you're in, but you can never repair the damage that you've done to those you've harmed. And that was kind of the story, was that in the long run, and we sort of touched on it, we got there a little bit with Fall of Harbinger, where you see Peter now as like a loving family man, and the leader of the free world, and you know what I mean? It has all this immense power and handles it responsibly and is about sacrifice and adoration of family. So we got there in this one issue, but my hope was that, you know, was that Peter would eventually become a better human being who would never make those choices again. And Chris would never, ever fully forgive him. But she would also but she would still be a healthy, strong character who was able to use that experience to increase her strength. And that was ultimately what I wanted to do with that storyline. But that was a really long play, and comics is a volatile business, and it's hard to pull off those long plays. But if you look at the arc of Peter in my run, he starts from a very, very bad place, and then he becomes an increasingly better human being throughout the arc, one issue at a time, until the death of Flamingo. And then he bottoms out in Omega, you know, in Omegas. He completely bottoms out. And then the original intention was that I would come back, create a new series, and in that series, that would really be, in many ways, characterologically about the rise of Peter Stanchek as a global positive force.
Yeah, I'm on board. I would read that, but I'm glad that you answered in that way, because it really is a two-part question. There's the question of, can Pete be redeemed in terms of the narrative?
Yeah, and is he a villain was the second part, right? I didn't really answer that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that is anybody a fucking hero? Is anybody a villain? I mean, that's kind of the point of the book, is that everyone does the best they can, and sometimes the bad guys do beautiful things because they mean the best of intentions. And sometimes the good guys do horrible things because they're people and they make really big mistakes in selfish plays. And that's just what it means to be human. So it's these questions, you know, whenever we ask the question, is Harada a villain or a hero? My ultimate answer is that he's a villain because he has chosen to end life for his own purposes. And sometimes that's been very petty choices. And so it doesn't matter if you save a million people, as far as I'm concerned, if you're willing to take one life to do it, then it's questionable that it's worth it. On the other hand, ultimately, Peter is a hero because he's trying with everything he has to change. And that's the heroic act that every human being takes on every day, is to try to be better, try to change, try to overcome the things that are dark inside of you that were encoded from family or genetics or whatever, or society. And so so that's the heroic act. And the villainous act from Harada is the ego, the selfishness, the inability to question himself. And so in these very broad terms, they are the traditional hero and the villain. The problem is I just don't even believe in these absolutes. So neither do my characters.
Yeah. Well, on some level, you know, like we were talking about with isms, you know, the label of hero or villain is just the packaging. You know, again, it matters what's inside, and the imperfections of us as people, as humans. And like you said, the heroic act is trying to overcome those imperfections.
Yeah. I mean, you know, people don't look at, you know, I mean, Jesse said it, right? Like, I mean, I know it's something that we use a lot in narrative fiction, that, you know, you're the hero of your own story, even if you're the villain. But that's, you know, that is exactly true. It's the person we most empathize with is ourself. So, you know, we're never going to fit into a very clear, at least not to ourselves, into a very clear, like, label. You know, that's just not how it works. People are just way more complex than that. So I try to bring a little bit of that to the characters in the comics.
Yeah. And like you said, you know, that narrative, that plan, that character arc for Peter that you had, of him, you know, ultimately being redeemed, it always comes back to two parts, like the narrative you want to tell, but then whether or not the readers buy into that, you know, whether or not he can be redeemed in terms of the story you're telling, doesn't mean that, you know, the readers, you know, buy it. And that's always a challenge as well.
Right, exactly. And, you know, that is why, yeah, that's why Chris, you know, Chris represents that kind of reader, you know, which is, you know, you know, some people have had such terrible experiences that the fight or flight response can be engaged very easily when they're reminded of them. And fiction is a really powerful tool, and it can unintentionally engage the limbic system of a reader. And that reader is going to have a response to the things that occur in that book that are going to be deeply personal. And that response is going to be completely authentic and completely true, whether it was the writer's and artist's and creator's intention to invoke that response or not. And you cannot, you just can't negate that reader's experience because it wasn't your intention. Because that reader's experience is more authentic than your intention that you wrote 1,000 notes about and, you know, and got high and walked on the beach and like, this is what I'm going to do. That's not nearly as authentic as a limbic system response to something they're reading. So you can never disregard how the reader perceives the work, especially big, bold, and even maybe dangerous choices like the kinds of things we did in the first issue.
Yeah. Is there anything else?
Does that make sense? Did I,
no,
does that
no,
sound
it,
like,
yeah, yeah, it yeah. makes complete, it makes complete sense.
Okay. Okay, cool.
But I wanted to ask you, Jesse, did you have any other questions about kind of the beginnings of Harbinger that you wanted to ask Josh?
No, I think we're tracking on that. You know, we've ad nauseum discussed Harada in the past. I personally have always believed Harada to be mostly a hero from an ethical mm-hmm. standpoint.
Yeah.
And that's only because as a lifelong government pun myself, I've gone to war under Obama. I've gone to war mm-hmm. under Bush. I've gone to war under Trump. Mm-hmm. And from my perspective, I was doing the same thing. And regardless of what was coming out of the mouth of these, you know, very diverse set of and lineup of leaders.
Yeah.
And
yes.
I've worked in foreign countries all over the world with where there are dictators or there are rulers or there are kings even. And they look so benevolent or so evil or whatever the flavor of opinion is of the day. But what really matters in the end is what actually happened.
Yeah.
It's not the intentions. It's not the show, the dog and pony show. It's what actually plays out.
Yeah.
And you know, when I look at it from my perspective, I look at Pete, and he should have been, or maybe could have been, redeemed, for, you know, in some way or the other. But he really had no plan. He had
right.
no real benefit for humanity. He really didn't do anything good. He just kind of, you know, was a person that was overburdened with a tremendous amount of power.
Yeah.
Whereas Harada, on the other hand, he definitely has taken life, as have most world stage level leaders, but at the same time, you know, he's contributed more to humanity in many respects than, you know, he could in 1,000 lifetimes. So
yeah.
There's a number of standpoints we can take on this, and all people do. I
yeah.
know that Harada is supposed to be the villain.
Because he's marketed that
right.
way.
Right. However, yeah. you know, the worth of a tree by the fruit that it bears, I think is what the religious nuts would say. So I'm very interested ultimately in this story and where it goes and how it's played out, even though it's already in my mind been amazing.
Awesome.
I track it like that. And there's a lot of ethical debates on it. I know that we, in my line of work, we look at people's behavior patterns. And we judge them oftentimes by, are they committing a sin of the mind or a sin of the heart?
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that, not like a religious thing, but are they making
yes.
a mistake because they didn't know better and lack the experience, or are they making a mistake because they're bad and evil?
Yes.
Because it, you know, how you judge them oftentimes has that. We all make mistakes, but we don't all have evil, you know, ready to just
yes.
pounce all over somebody else or cause harm. And so... there is a learning curve for leadership, which is why most ambassadors, presidents, and kings tend to be in their 60s as opposed to, you know, 21-year-old
yes.
kids.
Yes. There was a lot of great stuff that you just said in that in your response to that. That was awesome. And there's some of it I want to unpack. Everything you said is completely true. And, you know, there's this there's like a few really great beats I want to elaborate on. This notion, first of all, of going to war, like I really appreciate and love what you just said about essentially, and I don't mean to put words in your mouth, essentially war looks the same regardless of, you know, whether it's Obama's war or Trump's war, right, or Bush's war. Like it's the same thing, and the rhetoric doesn't change that. And you know, and we should be just as angry about, you know, about Obama increasing his, I mean, I don't mean to politicize what you're saying because what you said wasn't political, but I personally am very angry at the way Obama handled the drone war. Very angry about, you know, as a person of my political bent. So I love what you said about that, and you're absolutely right. I think that, and I love the sin of the mind and sin of the heart analogy is really, really beautiful. I think that Yeah, I think that's a completely valid philosophical way to approach it. Absolutely. I think that what I also wanted to add to complicate the philosophical soup, right, that or the ethical soup that we're engaged in when we talk about who's the villain and who's the hero here, is that ultimately Peter adopts a philosophical position that no action is action, that all action ends in horror and death, and that ultimately him taking no action, him not using his powers in any way, is the best way to abdicate himself from causing harm. And this is sort of a surface read on Buddhism, right? Like inaction mm-hmm. is action. And that's ultimately where he is in Omegas. And that was, you know, and that's sort of his like low point. That's both his low point in regards to how he views his role in society, but it's also a low point in his drug addiction. It's a low point in his self-worth and all this stuff. So that would be how Peter would respond to what you had said, is like, you know, Harada can do, he can believe in his mind as much as he wants, and he can do his best to help people. But in the end, it's only going to cause more death, more harm. That would be Peter's response to that. Whereas I'm going to take my power, I'm going to wrap it up into a little ball, and it's never going to hurt another human being again. I'm also not going to ever affect the lives of another human being again, because, you know, because to be is to hurt, is to cause harm, particularly to be with so much power. So that would be Peter's, that's not necessarily, you know, what I kind of believe them all at the same time equally, but that would be Peter's response to why he does the things he does. But I love what you just said was really awesome and also true.
If not, trying to be thought provoking.
Well, I don't see to be, yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, so and I've told you this before, Josh, this is what your writing does. It provokes thought, which is why it's my favorite type of comics that make you think. It's the value.
That's awesome. I really appreciate it. I mean, part of it also is the intellect of the reader. You know, this is Jesse is bringing his own amazing experiences to it. And that's really nice. I think I make work where I do ask the reader to meet me halfway. I don't take it all the way to the reader's doorstep. Right. I don't say everything. You know, I don't like and I kind of don't like writing that does that, even though it's quite popular. So I appreciate you saying that. And I try my best. And I think it's just because part of my process is working through these questions myself. So I think it hits the page that way. And then people who are, you know, people who are akin to me in that regard, they probably feel it. So.
Yeah, definitely. It's probably why we have such a good time when we hang out.
Nice.
Well, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but I did want to ask if you had anything that you wanted to tease our valiant fans here about life and death of Toyo Harada.
Well, A, you're not taking up my time. This is super fun. And B, I don't know. Do I want to tease something about life and death? I mean, it's just going to be... I basically have spent, you know, these years at Valiant, or those years at Valiant, making those comics. I basically was a ground school for me, or boot camp, I mean, for me to learn how to, can I tell entertaining, over-the-top, science fiction, super-powered stories that are fun and have all the elements that we love in comics and still keep them politically challenging, ethically challenging, characterologically challenging, thematically challenging. And so I worked really hard over the course of Harbinger and Omegas and Imperium to learn that craft. And sometimes I did it well, sometimes I did it wrong. I do believe in my heart that, and this is not a story, you know, a hint or anything, but I believe in my heart that working on that skill set, like, can I say something important without ever muting the joy of comics, the aliens, the robots, the space elevators, can I go really big, really grand, really epic in comic books and still be very challenging, you know, ethically and thematically. And I feel really good about the outcome. So, yeah, that would be, I know that's like a non-standard hint about what's coming. It's really just hype, but that would be how I would say it. I feel really good about the scripts. I feel really good about the art that's coming in. I feel really good about it as a final statement on, or my final statement on Toyo Harada. And then I can finally pass the ball on. I've been a little bit selfish with Harada for years now. He's been absent from the Valiant Universe. And that was literally just because of the dedication and the belief that first Warren and Dinesh and then the new team that came in, Carl and crew, that they had in me, was they're like, we're going to take our biggest, most popular character off the table so that Josh can finish his story. And that's a huge gift and a huge responsibility they gave me. So I think I paid it back in full, I hope. So I think it's going to be cool. And I think and then I can let other people play with my toys. I can learn how to play with others after that.
Finally, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Finally.
But no, I think it's great because I think, you know, a lot of what you just said reminds me of why I love Valiant so much, right? Like when this new iteration of Valiant came out, I came back to Valiant for the characters, but I stayed because of the creators and the people that were there. And it's kind of the same thing with a lot of what you just said, right? Like you come to your stories, your narratives that you're telling because you love comics, but you stay because they do all those things that we've been talking about. They make you think and they challenge you know, your ideals politically, you know, morally, ethically, you know, makes you look at your own self in a mirror and see your own imperfection. So great. And I think it's what made you such a perfect fit for Valiant.
You know, that's it's interesting. It is really interesting how that group came together. And I mean, I guess Warren saw in those original Valiant books the efforts that were made at that time to do these things, right? To make challenging comics that still were comics, not to completely throw out the good time comic book feeling. I think he was pretty accurate in the teams that he chose for the books. I think he kind of knew who we were and he found the right books for us. I think that was one of his great talents. So that's how we ended up with, well, at least that first generation of Valiant people, or at least the Dinesh Warren era.
Yeah, 100%. I agree. Well, is there anything else that you have coming up, or anything else that you want to share with our listeners? We'll give you the opportunity.
Man, I'm so frustrated. I have another book that's going to be announced soon, and I just can't talk about it, and it's killing me. But there's going to be, other than Life and Death, there'll be another announcement very soon, another book of mine, wholly original property, that is going to drop and be, first issue will be available for free. And that should happen very soon around the time that Life and Death is happening, which will be really nice. You know, I haven't actually put a physical comic book on the stand, in about 4 years. So I've been working all that time, but I do feel a little invisible. So I'm excited for all this new work to come out.
Well, if any of our listeners, if they want to follow along on social media, so they'll know when that announcement's made and when Life and Death is about to drop, where's the best place to keep track of your work?
So, my relationship with social media is kind of weird and tenuous. However, right now I'm probably being the most active on Twitter. I do have a Facebook account. You can reach out to me there. I'm a little bit less active on it right now. So I'm at Twitter and Facebook under my own name, Joshua Dysart.
Great. And listeners, I'll put links in the show notes to Josh's social media so you can go and click there and follow. So it's great to talk to you as always, Josh. Thanks for joining us, man. Really appreciate it.
Oh, man, it's my pleasure. It's always wonderful to talk to you. It's nice to meet you, Jesse. I hope to see you in Proximal Space someone day.
It's going to happen, man.
Nice. Awesome. Yeah, man, this is great. I really, really always appreciate talking to you.
Yeah. And we'll talk soon. Next time I'm in SoCal, I'll hit you up. We'll have to grab some dinner.
I love it. Let's do it.
All right, man. Take care. Thanks so much.
Okay. Ciao to the both of you.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
All right, everybody. So you just heard us talk to Joshua Dysart, writer of Harbinger. Really great guy. I really encourage you, if Josh is ever at a convention that you're at, to go over and talk to him, because I mean, you will spend an hour at his table just talking to him. He's such an interesting guy and has a lot of interesting ideas. And he's such a real warm, genuine person who loves comic fans. So I encourage you to do that. So Jesse and I are going to take a few minutes to go through the first issue of Harbinger 1. I'm not going to get too into detail. Again, a lot of this stuff and the themes and all that we just talked about with Josh, but I do want to kind of give you an idea if you haven't read it, or there may be a few things here that spark some other ideas that we didn't talk about. So the issue starts off. Well, first let me give the creative team. It's written by obviously Joshua Dysart. We have art by Kari Evans, and is it the inks by Ian Han, I believe, it's the colors rather. Yeah, it's the colors by Ian Hannon and letters by Rob Steen. So the issue actually starts out in the past. It's the year 1951, and we're in Tibet, and we see a figure on a horse approach a monastery, and it's a young Toyo Harada. He uses his powers to get into the temple where there are many Chinese Red Army soldiers, I think is who they're supposed to be. And they're trying to prevent Harada from getting into the monastery. He uses his powers to basically force them to protect Harada from themselves, which causes them to turn their guns on each other. And we do learn through the exposition boxes here that it's Toyo Harada is his name. He's 18 years old. And as he gets deeper into the temple, he comes upon the bleeding monk, who ends up being a pretty important figure in the Harbinger story, who is actually a character we've never spoken to Josh about with on the podcast. That'll have to be maybe the next time we have him on. It would be interesting to get his ideas and kind of figure out how he came up with the idea of the bleeding monk. And so Harada tells the monk, you know, I've dreamed of you. You're the monk who bleeds but doesn't die. I came all this way, and I didn't know if you were real. And the monk says, you know, it's not for me to speak on what is real. But part of the whole reason that Harada went there is he did sense this being existed. And, you know, we know from what Harada is hoping to accomplish with his dream of utopia that his own future and the future of the world is something that interests him greatly. And part of the reason he went to see the bleeding monk is because he had a belief that the bleeding monk could see his future. Would he share that knowledge with Harada or not and would Harada choose to believe it is kind of a recurring theme and a story thread that runs throughout Harbinger. But when he sits at this moment, when he meets Bleeding Monk for the first time and asks, hey, can you see my future? He says, yes, Harbinger, I see your future. And I love the way Josh puts this. It's so poetic. It's an unassuming wind waiting to be whipped into a storm. And that's a great way to describe Harada, both as kind of a force, and I don't want to say a force of nature, but just a force in the world. Because even now at 18 years old, with the power level that he has, he is able to affect so much, just like the wind, right? And obviously when you start talking about wind increasing in power till it becomes a storm, you know, we think of storms as destructive, right? And so it's such a great way to give us foreshadowing of what's to come with Toyo Harada. Then as we turn the page, we're in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We meet Peter Stanchek when he's 18 years old. And we're now in modern day. And again, great art by Cardi Evans. We see Peter moving through crowds, and there's all these word bubbles and word balloons around him. He's basically drowning in other people's thoughts to the point where he's self-medicating. He's using his powers to rob pharmacies of medication and money, and then makes the people forget that he was even there. So he uses these medications to basically get super high and drown out the voices, right? Or block them out, these voices that he himself is drowning in, just to get some peace and quiet. And, you know, we talked quite a bit with Josh about Pete Stanchek, you know, hero villain, I think Jesse would agree with me that, you know, you give this level of power to an 18-year-old, and to Josh's point earlier, somebody who's never had a normal childhood, normal love, normal kind of support and upbringing, that's already a flawed person. And you give this level of power, of course they're going to be only focused on themselves. Of course it's going to be all about doing whatever they need to do to survive or to relieve their pain. So the self-medication, while you can look down on it as a weakness, it does make sense, especially for someone so young. So as we follow Pete, he meets up with his buddy Joe, who we learn has some kind of mental issues himself. And when Joe doesn't take his antipsychotic medication, his thoughts are so crazy that it's chaos in a can, is how Pete kind of describes it. So Pete, whenever he steals opioids for himself, he always gets antipsychotics for Joe. And Joe, like many people who suffer from mental illness, doesn't like to take the medication because it kind of dulls everything out, and you don't really feel alive. You're kind of sleepwalking through life. So, but Joe relents and says, you know, you're my friend, for you, I'm going to go ahead and do it. And they take off and head to the old neighborhood where Pete grew up. And Joe's expressing concern about, it's not really smart for them to be coming back to their hometown. You know, they've been on the run for quite a long time. 6 cities in 7 months, and how long can they really stay on the run? And Pete says, you know, maybe I just wanted to come home before we're too far gone or whatever. So they find an abandoned house, and they break in, and they sleep there for the night. As we turn the page, we move to the Lap of Luxury, the headquarters of Harada Conglomerates. And much like Josh said earlier, at the beginning of this story, Harada is, you know, all about capitalism, all about building wealth and using that wealth to try to better the world, try to be an altruist in every sense of the word. So sometimes he'll do things that aren't going to be looked on as – they're going to be looked on as greedy, right? Like purchasing a bunch of Syrian oil. You know, supporting Syria financially is not going to be looked at, even at you know, at this time, 2012, when the book came out. It's not going to be looked on as something that's good, right? So Harada's ordering his PR people to, you know, put the best spin, as best positive spin as possible on it. They're buying Syrian oil, but they're going to use that oil to then donate to the rest of the world to kind of ease the strain of the world economy. And they also are in the middle of deploying all these medbots that can be deployed to help in war zones and try to help in Europe and Asia and Africa. Again, it's using his vast wealth to try to better the world. But what we also understand from what Harada's doing here is he's definitely a puppet master. He's definitely pulling the strings and trying to direct the world to go into the way he wants it to go. So once he finishes his meeting, he's given all his drones, human drones, I guess I should say, so to speak, their marching orders. He excuses them all, and he says, "Show me Peter Stanchek," and he uses his mental abilities to spy on Peter, who is back at the house, and Joe's outside, and Pete's kind of worried, like, "Hey, you're going to be spotted," and Joe's like, "Yeah, it's fine. You know, there's a fence. It's no big deal." And Pete's asking him, "Hey, you know, can you take your meds so we can have a chill day? And I don't see or don't hear all the chaos in your mind." And Joe says, "Sure, got it right here," and throws it into his mouth, but then as soon as Pete turns his back, he spits it out. And then as the morning continues, we find out the real reason that Pete wanted to come to this specific house. And we see Chris Hathaway go walking by the front. And Chris is an old childhood friend of Peter's. And she features kind of prominently in all the good memories he has of his childhood, the memories that weren't terrible. And so Pete walks outside, says hi to Chris, and she pretends not to remember him. And Pete's kind of like, "How can you not remember me? We lived next to each other." And Chris, you know, again, playing it cool. "Yeah, I don't know how I'm not supposed to remember you, but I don't know how I'm supposed to answer that." And then asks if he's back. And he says, "Oh, I'm just passing through." And then she, you know, like, oh, I got to go to class. See you later. And Pete is kind of crestfallen. He's like, ah, it was really good to see you again. Meanwhile, Joe's gone to the park. Probably not the best thing to do when you are on the run to be seen in a public place. And he's not there very long before some cops show up and take him into custody. They recognize him as a missing person. He had escaped from the mental hospital. Meanwhile, Pete is at the bus stop and he's remembering better times with Chris and again, starting to hear the voices of other people in his head and taking more pills. And he eventually makes his way to Chris's high school. And as Chris is leaving, he shows up there and says hi. And Chris is like freaked out. Like, why are you following me? Pete's like, I'm not trying to freak you out. And I love what Chris says. She's like, well, not try harder. And Pete's like, I just don't remember how you cannot remember me. You were, you know, I just wanted to see you. And I wanted to have, you know, a chance to see you again. I took a big chance coming back home just to see you because you're something good in my life. And I don't have very much good in my life. And how can you not remember that? And then Chris actually confesses to him. She's like, you know what? I do remember you. I remember that everybody in the neighborhood was afraid of you. You were creepy and weird. And we were all happy when you left. And Pete, he starts to lose it. He's like, you weren't afraid of me at first. You know, we are normal kids together. I love you. And Chris is having none of it. Like, what are you talking about, dude? We are 10 years old. That's not love. That's boredom. And Pete tries to unload on her, you know, give her an idea of what he's been through. He's like, I've been in the hospital all this time. That's the only thing I ever had was our friendship. And you got to understand, I have these powers. I hear people's thoughts in my mind as far back as I can remember. And I had such a hard time dealing with it. And Chris is like, you know, I don't need a guilt trip from a stranger. Why don't you leave me alone? And Pete's still trying to reach out to her saying, you know, what do you expect a little kid to do when he goes through that? Like, give me a chance. I'm losing my grip. And that's where this is where he makes the mistake. The thing that Josh talked about, that he struggles with the fact that he made this choice. And Pete says, wait, and uses his powers on her. Wait, come here, fall in love with me. And she does, you know, he's completely manipulated her mind. He's stolen her free will. You can almost think, I've heard some Valiant fans who don't like what Josh did here. Like, I've been in panels where people have, confronted him about this and said, this is worse than Pete killing her. You know, just completely robbing her of self. So as we move on to the next page, we see Joe in the police precinct and he's confronted by this guy named Tull. He calls him Mr. Dull Tull, and apparently he works for some shadowy organization that's been pursuing Pete and Joe. And apparently time and time again, Pete has used his powers on Tull and erased his mind and left him lying naked in the street. But yet he keeps coming, and Joe kind of antagonizes him, saying, you know, I when we first met you, you seemed like a real person and you were vibrant and kind of full of life. And, you know, I think Pete's wipes are having a long-term effect on you because you're just like a blank space now. You're just empty. The people that run you basically just download another copy of whatever into your brain. And it's a copy of a copy of a copy. And you know, eventually there's not going to be much left of you. Tull doesn't really rise to the bait, though. And he antagonizes Joe right back, and they eventually just let Joe go. And obviously they have reasons for doing that. So back at the abandoned house, we see that Pete has gone to sleep with Chris, and they've probably done things that they really should not have done, that Pete really should not have done. As Pete lays there looking at her saying, I can't believe you're really here. He hears a voice calling him outside. When he goes outside, it's a dog that's talking to him, and he's like, what is going on? A talking dog. And then he sees visions of other dogs attacking him, and he falls into the empty swimming pool. And the original dog is saying, look at me, Peter. Look at me to see what's real. And Pete's like, what is real? And then when he realizes that what he's seeing is not real, he finds himself in a garden. And the voice tells him, the first lesson is that many of us can cast mental projections and you can see through them if you learn to focus. So this is Pete meeting Harada for the first time, and Harada reaching out saying, you know, I've followed you. I've been dreaming about you for years. I've been watching you from afar. You're a psiot, which is a very, very rare thing in the human race to have these abilities. And what's even more rare is to be born with your powers activated, like I was and like you are. And Pete's like, are you Tull's boss? And Harada says, no, actually, quite the opposite. Tull's organization is dangerous, and they're closer than you think. You need to be careful of him. You know, I'm Toyo Harada. He tells Pete about the gifts and about the three different type of people there are in the Valiant universe: the normals, the latents who have that psiot ability that hasn't been unlocked, and then the ones born activated that are very, very rare, as Pete and Harada are. And when Harada tells him how unique he is and how beautiful, Pete's like, well, why didn't you ever come to me earlier when I needed help and I needed understanding? Because Harada professes to know Pete better than he knows himself. And he says, you know, you wouldn't have accepted me if I'd come sooner. And I don't know that you'll accept me now, but I don't have a choice. This is an intervention, because there's nothing left on the path you're heading down except absolute self-destruction. You know, you can't keep living on the run, self-medicating, dampening your own powers. And you think you're doing what's best for Joe, but you're actually keeping him from getting help. And then there's this Chris girl. And this is probably the last straw for Harada, right? Like, if Pete does this, if he commits this terrible atrocity or keeps it up, it is ultimately going to lead to his self-destruction. And Pete, for his part, in his defense, does realize what he's done is wrong. He's like, I've never, you know, don't say what I did to her. I've never done anything like it before. You can tell the guilt is already there. And Harada's like, yeah, you're at the end of your rope. You've been on the run too long. You're making bad decisions. You've lost sight of who you are. And the world right now is kind of in the same state. You know, it's at the end of history. It's ending. And we had all these resources to craft a wonderful civilization, and we've squandered it. We've been greedy, but there's still time to course correct if we can set aside our self-destructive natures. But I'm the only – here's where the ego comes in for Harada. I'm the only one on Earth who can train you to reach your full potential. I'm – you know, Harada, I'm the one who needs to make the decisions. I'm the one that can save the world. And so Harada tells Pete about the Harbinger Foundation, how he has a program for people like us, a safe place where Pete can learn and find purpose and perhaps even be happy. But the training that he's offering takes total dedication. He's got to leave Joe. He's got to release Chris, and he can come and live a life that's worthy of the talents. And as Pete is sitting at the bottom of the swimming pool talking to this dog, Joe shows up and he's like, three things in no particular order. Hot chick sleeping in the house. You're talking to a dog in an empty swimming pool, and you don't have to worry about Tull chasing us anymore. He gave up, man. He said it was cool. He just let me go. But the reason he let Joe go, they followed him, right? And so there's helicopters above, and they shine a spotlight down on Pete and say, stay where you are. Our house is surrounded. And obviously, you know, Pete knows right away what happened. God damn it, Joe, they followed you. And Joe's like, oh, it's like a Michael Bay movie. And we see like paramilitary soldiers surrounding the house, heading in to take Pete and Joe into custody. And we get the credit box there, Omega Rising Part 1. So like I was telling Josh when we first started our conversation, so many layers here, so much to unpack. You would almost think in reading, if you didn't have any prior knowledge of the Valiant universe and you didn't know anything about any of these characters, and you read this, you could almost say, well, Pete's the villain. He's the one that has done the bad stuff, and Harada's probably the hero. Right, it could easily read like that. We know that not to be the case, and you know that'll start to unfold as we continue on with the chronology. But it's a spectacular first issue, and whenever anybody is looking to like, where should I start in Valiant? What should I read? This is one of the things I always recommend. And not only like I want to start reading Valiant, but if somebody tells me I want to start reading comics, like what are some good comics to read? I always give them, direct them to Harbinger number 1 through 25, always. So it's spectacular in its simplicity. You know, like Josh was saying, what the synopsis can be summed up in just a couple words, but there's so much more to it than that. So I think it's a great first issue, and interesting the choices that Josh made. And it was great talking to him to hear some of his thoughts about why he made the decisions that he made. What do you have to add about issue 1, Jesse?
Well, I'll start out with a couple of things. The first is if there was a pitch for Harbinger based on this first issue, and in my mind there is, this is how X-Men should have been. This is how X-Men should have started. Not four mutants to go and work for Professor Xavier, who just happens to be, you know, very, very noble and benevolent and train them, and they all do the right thing and they all follow orders and they all like work together as a cohesive team, because that is not reality. That has never been reality. Reality would be what we see in Harbinger, which is everybody is flawed, regardless of their intentions. Who you are as a person, mixed with the powers and abilities you have, has a great bit to say about what goes on and what will come. You read about Pete, and really in the end of it all, Pete's kind of like the dirty scumbag nobody, but you know, here he is, you know, the one of the strongest psyops on Earth. You know, he didn't ask for it, but he's got it. Had that magical power never have occurred, well, we would have never even given him a second look. And Toyo, yes, he's got ego and he's out of control in certain respects, but he's technically correct in that he, from a power perspective, might actually, if not 100%, be the only one on Earth that can train Pete. There's value to that. He knows the power. He knows, how to use it. He knows, you know, now whether or not that's correct or not, or the ethics of it is a whole different story, but Pete is, just drugging himself up, walking around and, raping women. You know, he's a dangerous guy. He is a villain. Now, mind you, we all do things that are irredeemable. I mean, that's almost why religion even started up, you know, in many respects, you know, like what Christianity kicked off so strong was, you know, that we are all sinful and flawed, and there must be some higher power that, you know, could reach for and beg forgiveness for, to atone for our sins so we can become born again. Supposedly that was the case, right? But in the world without such a thing, I don't know. I mean, we all live our lives, with our evil pasts and our sinful natures, and whether that's ego or lust or gluttony or whatever the seven deadly sins of the day are. We know what Pete's are. We watch him do it. We also see the pride and arrogance in Toyo. I think it's a phenomenal issue. I think it's a phenomenal start. Considering it came and the genesis of it was, you know, one of the greatest comic books coming out of the 1990s, which would, some people argue on certain lists and articles would be the most important book and series of the 90s, it was a phenomenal place to start. Like you said, you recommend people read issues 1 through 25, and I would recommend it as well. Because there's enormous value to it, there's entertainment value to it, it's thought-provoking, and it's quality entertainment.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I'm really happy that we've, I mean, not that I wasn't happy to read EXO, but I'm really excited that we've gone on, we've moved from the first couple of volumes of EXO to covering the first couple of volumes of Harbinger, because it's been a couple of years since I've read it. I've read it many times and I remember all of it, but it's still enjoyable to go back and read it. And it was super great to talk to Josh today. I always have such a great time talking to that guy, because it's just so interesting to hear what goes on in his head, right? And comics that make you think, you know, I've said it 1,000 times are my favorite ones, because it's good to self-reflect, right? It's good to constantly learn and evolve and grow just as a person. And the other thing is, if you want to look at more of the cynical side of it, it's more value for your comic dollar, right? I mean, comics aren't cheap these days. So anything where you're thinking about it, you know, the next day, later that day, whatever, a week later, you know, whatever it might be, that's, to me, that's more value. You're getting more value for your comic book. I will say that as far as the art goes, it's okay. I've never been a big fan of Kari Evans. I think that for the most part, the art is really good. I don't really care, and I've said this before on the podcast, I think I don't really care for the way that he draws faces. I think that to me, it's the faces that really bug me. The eyes often feel a little too small, and the faces look a little weird at times, and it kind of throws me. But for the most part, the art's great. The storytelling, his transitions from panel to panel are excellent. Never have a problem following the narrative or anything like that. So And the colors, it's pretty primary actually for being such a kind of a non-traditional superhero book. It's very much primary, so it looks much more like a traditional superhero book than you might expect. But that might also have been a conscious choice, just because it was a new publisher trying to get off the ground. You do want to look traditional in some ways, even though it's as Josh said earlier, doing something so different than what Marvel or DC was doing at the time, or even is still doing, really.
Well, success. Yeah. They did it.
Yeah, exactly. Any comments on the art, Jesse? I'm kind of curious about your. Are you a Evans fan?
So it was the first issue. It was actually the second series after the 2012 reboot. So they were getting their feet on the ground. It's not a bad start. And you know, you see Kari as a mainstay through and through with the publisher. It would have, if I had to go back in time, I might have used Clayton Henry.
Yeah,
but I don't even know if Clayton was working for him at the time or with him at the time. I just liked Clayton's take and renditions of the Harbinger world. I think he got captured the characters better, and I really liked his proportions and his dynamic of each page.
Yeah, Barry Kitson too. I loved when he came on later, the work he did on the series. So. But anyway, I think that's going to do it for this episode. Hope you all enjoyed our chat with Josh and our look back at Harbinger number one. The next time we do a chronology, we'll be on to Harbinger number two. I'll take a quick look at the calendar here. I don't know if that's – I think next week, actually, we're going to be covering Harbinger two. And then the following week after that – and I haven't even told you this, Jesse, but what I want to do for the Sunday right before Thanksgiving in celebration of the holidays, we're going to do a top five Valiant Entertainment International, the VEI iteration of Valiant, top five titles. So if it's a one shot, if it's, you can't pick like, okay, Harbinger, right? And all the Harbinger stuff, you've got to, or you can't just say Bloodshot or Shadow Man. You've got to pick a specific volume of it. Say, Shadow Man volume one or the Shadow Man and, the Andy Diggle volume. And you've got to narrow it down to five. Maybe six if you want to give something a tie. We can, this is our mountain of beans, our hill of beans, and we can do what we want. So we can maybe fudge a little bit. But I'm going to see if I can get a few other of the old school Valiant fans on as well to talk about that. We'll get, three or four of us on, and we'll give our top five. I think you listeners out there really love when we do those kind of top fives. And then we're going to round out the month by coming back to the chronology with issue number two of Harbinger. Yeah. So yeah, issue one here on the 11th, and then the top five on the 18th, and then the 25th we'll do Harbinger number two. So that's what's coming up there. Thanks for joining, everybody. As always, please tell your friends about us, subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.